Welcome to Mental Illness in Pop Culture. This week we are going to be talking about the film The Stanford Prison Experiment, as well as the event that that's based on. I'm Scott.
This is Leanne.
This is Joe.
And we would like to welcome our guest podcaster, Andre Joaquim. Welcome, Andre.
Hi, I'm Andre. Everyone calls me Dre. I'm a second-year doc student in the Counselor Education and Supervision Program. And I also have my NCC and my LPC in counseling.
So I don't know what direction our conversation will go in. So many things I wanted to talk about while watching this film. Some of them may be issues related to power, authority, conformity, obedience, gender issues, and ethics. Anyway, Andre, we kind of wanted you to be our guest podcaster on this episode for a reason, and I was wondering if you could share some of your initial impressions and a little bit about your understanding of what happened in this film.
Well, you know, some of the things that I recognize a lot of things from being in the prison system. I've been incarcerated four times, to be exact, and I've noticed so many similarities that went on in this film that happens in day-to-day life in the prison system. It just amazed me how spot on some of the things were as far as, the guards addressing the inmates and people becoming to conform to not their name, but a prison number. And just taking on all these different traits, either from fellow inmates or how they are supposed to respond and act and falling in compliance with some of the guards there. It was just, you know, it really touched me to see how much was simulated in this actual movie that happens in the prison system itself. And not only was it, like wowing to me, for lack of better words, but just having a chance to work in the mental health problem-solving courts field, I had a lot of chance to see that from an outside perspective as well. So seeing these things when I went into the county jail that inmates displayed, it was just, you know, it was just like, wow. I was lost for words when I got a chance to look at it. And I've heard of this, of the experiment or the, what is it called again?
The Stanford Prison Experiment.
But having a chance to see it depicted in this drama, I was just like amazed, but not amazed, and surprised and not surprised at the same time.
Let me ask you a high-level question, and I think we'll dig down further into this. But mm-hmm. So it mimics what you saw people change or conform into in those pressure power situations. What do you think is the motivator for why? I mean, these guys in the movie are in there for a day before they really become somebody else and 6 days before it's shut off.
Right.
Because it's, and you're saying it's so realistic. Is it fear? Where does that conformity start? What do you think?
Well, I think a lot of it is underlying fear. As far as the people who were presumed inmates, you know, some things that they did is, of course, the blindfold and taking into. I think that was a little bit out of context how people are brought into the system. But it could be metaphorically saying that sometimes we get ourselves in situations and we go in blindly. Mm-hmm. But some of the things that people do to change, to adapt, is a matter of survival. So you take on these roles and you act as if when you're placed in that position. You know, I had a chance to witness people coming and they come in very timid, and after certain situations, they're forced to adapt to become fear so strong, you know, because there's this thought of being a predator, not prey.
Survival.
Yes.
You know, my familiarity with the Stanford Prison Experiment was I heard about it in my undergraduate psychology classes and probably in high school, probably heard about it. And so in watching the film, I thought, well, this is sort of a cartoonish, two-dimensional, and I'm sure they took a lot of liberties and embellishments to make the film kind of deliver the message, but it probably stayed true to the meaning. And then I watched some documentaries on YouTube, and the film is exactly like what really happened to a T. The prisoners had the exact same numbers, and the dialogue was verbatim from what they really say in the documentaries.
So Dr. Zimbardo, is that his name?
Yeah, Philip Zimbardo.
So he's alive, and he was consulting on this film as they're going through it, and this is very true to what happened in 1971 when this actually took place.
Yeah, and I wanted to say about Zimbardo. So first, I knew of him before I knew that he was linked to the Stanford Prison Experiment, because in the 2000s, I used to watch educational TV for the fun of it. And there was this program I would watch all the time called Understanding Psychology. It was on Channel 20. And he was the host of it. And I thought, kind of a cool guy. Mm. Then I see him portrayed, and then I found out he was involved with the Stanford Prison Experiment. And throughout this film, he is a total dick. Huh. Until right at the end. Right. And then he's now devoted his life to prevent happening what happens in the Stanford Prison Experiment.
And when I think about that, I think it's so funny, because being in the system, I saw a lot of these things take place on a daily basis between inmates exchanging with inmates and inmates exchanging with guards. You know, a lot of things, a lot of rules that they had of how you address, or how they kind of like lay out the rules when you come in and tell you what you're allowed and what you're not allowed to do, and even take away and keep away your rights within the prison system, is very true to the experiment.
As I understand, one thing that was different, because I think authenticity, especially to stories like this, is really important. If I'm not mistaken, in the real story, the prisoners were basically taken from their dorm rooms, if I'm not mistaken.
They were arrested at their homes.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were arrested by real police. The police department where Stanford is, they cooperated.
Yeah. Did the Miranda rights, the whole bit, said that they were being arrested for burglary, I think, or something like that. Yeah.
So, as an experiment, I mean,
that's intense.
That's really keeping it in
character. Wow, yeah.
Well, I mean, how quickly they find their character. So going back to your comment, Scott, about Dr. I just am going to mess up his name. So the doctor. I was in like a constant moral conflict watching him. Did you guys feel like that? Like,
yes.
You said he was a dick the whole time, and at the end he shows some compassion. So I don't know if I would define him as a dick, as that he was so true to the study.
Right.
And these were like participants in the study, and the entire purpose of it was for it to be as authentic as possible.
Right.
And so I really thought that he was that like profound researcher, like true to the project.
I completely agree.
And then, you know, we're looking at it from an empathetic place, going, well, that guy's a dick. And it felt like that, but I had such a hard time. Like, I wrote down in my notes, so it was in the middle of the movie, is this a bad guy or a good guy? I'm uncertain I know the answer.
I never had that question. I always just kind of took it as he's a researcher. He has a really powerful question that he's trying to investigate. And he knows that what he is asking the participants of his study to do could get ugly, and more likely than not, will get ugly. You know, but if you're trying to get at some deeper truth about human nature, whether that's psychologically or philosophically, then sooner or later, you're going to get dirty.
What do you think about when, you know, it does get physical a couple times?
Yeah.
And it ends based on a real interesting kind of get physical moment, right? But there's, you know, somebody gets hit with the billy club stick, whatever mm-hmm. it's called, and, you know, they kind of don't see that. But, you know, there's... Is it in group counseling? I don't know. Scott and I have had this conversation, so I'm not sure which class, but obviously what you're kind of able to get by with, what you can do, and no one kind of steps in the way and says, hey, we said that was a rule. You can't do it.
Right.
So they never went in there and ran in to proclaim, hey, remember, that's not a rule. And so don't you think that that sort of began to give permission
for more? Isn't that really... kind of at the end of the day, what
happens
in prison?
Yes.
I mean, I don't know nothing about it personally, yeah, right. But from what I have heard and seen on TV, guards have a lot of room to skirt institutional rules and regulations. While at the same time, prisoners also have a lot of room in their own milieu to skirt and create new regulations. So I think...
And even outside of the environment of the prison system, I think it's human nature. If you've been told something, but everybody else does it this way, or this isn't stopped,
right.
We push the envelope or we do more. Or...
I mean, it is a moral question, right? Mm-hmm. You know, how many of us are willing to do whatever we feel like we can get away with just because we can get away with it?
Well, depends on the situation, right?
Well, I have a couple thoughts in mind because the prison system, because I went into the prison system back around the, matter of fact, 90s, sort of early 90s, and I also been exposed to the prison system throughout the 90s into the 2000s. And what I've seen is... basically, when I went in, the prisoners had a lot more leeway. We could wear our own clothes. We can have certain things sent to us. And we had all these different privileges. And over the course of the years, like, and matter of fact, when I first came in, a lot of inmates kind of like had a free range on prison. And they would get a chance to do whatever certain things. They would have certain privileges that other inmates couldn't have. But over the course of the years, into the 2000s, those things have been taken away. And like how I was watching, I thought it was very interesting when they were talking about conformity, how all the guards would have the same thing, like the glasses, and it shows a conformity, uniformity for them to address the people, the inmates in there, and all the inmates would have basically these dresses, and they would have the same thing. And now, as the 2000 came around, everyone was basically wearing the same uniform or anything. No one had any street clothes or anything like that, which kind of set a status quo for all you guys are just inmates and you guys have no titles. You guys are stripped of any type of dignities from the world or whatever. So, you know, you don't get a chance to exude your power over one inmate over another. So, you know, I thought that was very interesting in that aspect of it.
Yeah, and that's what started to happen on day two in the movie and in real life with Prisoner 4816, played by Ezra Miller, who on a previous podcast was one of the stars of The Perks of Being a Wallflower. And so that's when... there was sort of this loss of identity. And that was part of what Zimbardo was going for in the experiment, was what will happen when people become sort of dehumanized. There were a couple of things that were not mentioned in the movie that happened in real life. And these are small things, but I think they may have influenced how the trajectory played out. One was Prisoner 4816. pretty early on said he wanted to get out of the experiment.
Right.
And Zimbardo, I don't know, there was some kind of conformity about, well, what will people think of you then or something like that. And 4816 misunderstood that you were not allowed to leave the experiment. And so he went back in with the rest of the prisoners and he told them, we're not allowed to choose to leave. And so that mindset developed. It's probably actually similar to what happens in prison. Additionally, then I think it was 4816 or someone finally did leave. Mm-hmm. And they thought that he was going to come back to plan an escape.
Right.
And so they broke down the whole prison and they from the basement of Stanford, I think it was Jordan Hall, and they moved it up to the third floor. And that caused all the guards to be really agitated that they had to do all this extra work. And then they ended up taking that out even more on the prisoners. And then, oh gosh, there was one more thing and now so I don't know how much this was portrayed in the film, but then, so once 4816 left, and so a substitute was brought in, who was almost like an outsider. Mm-hmm. And so everybody else had been engaged in this behavior, guards and prisoners, for a couple of days. I think it was 3 days. And then this new person came in and was like, WTF is going on here?
Yeah.
And refused to participate and did the hunger strike. And then, this was in the film, but then the prisoners kind of retaliated against the one who was trying to rebel against the prison guards.
Right.
And so these oppressed people chose to attack one of their own rather than take out their anger on the guards.
Right. And that just speaks to, like, say they know they cannot win against the guards. So what do? You turn on someone who has no more power than you do. You can go ahead and turn on this person. And, you know, you were saying, I think you were talking about, you touched a chord with me because you were able to spit out that number and everything like that. And, you know, when you go into the system, you're given this number. Like, even me, I've been out of the system for over 10 years. and I can remember my number, you know, B06789. And I can remember, I'll probably remember that number till the day I die, you know, because we're forced to put those numbers on outgoing mail. We're forced to answer to those numbers when the guards call your name, or they'll just call out your number and you have to say here, you know. And if you don't, there'll be repercussions for that. You know, whether it's segregation or getting tickets and enough tickets, you'll go segregation, you'll go to the hole, as they were saying, you know, that where they put prisoners that misbehave or who will not conform to the rules and regulations. So I just thought that was like, wow, that you're able to call off those numbers, because it only took me like, you know, maybe a couple of days because of my number, but everybody has these unique numbers to them. And not everyone is so lucky to have a random sequence of numbers like me, B06789. And some people really have trouble memorizing these numbers because it's usually like about, I guess, 5 numbers with a letter. And so, you know, just getting used to that, you know, you can see people struggle with that where they have to look at their prison IDs just to remember these numbers, just like how they were looking down at their shirt to remember, and the guards were telling them, no, you need to memorize, you need to know these numbers. And it's almost that sense, not to the exact, but almost like that when you go into prison. I thought that was like really intriguing.
Well, it's interesting that they would know that, or that it would be so similar, when these really just are young 20-somethings in an experiment. I don't know how much the doctor
and even late teens, like the John Wayne character, and he really had a John Wayne. They really called him John Wayne in real life. He was 18 years old and getting ready to be a freshman in college.
Wow. That's, I think, just the way the attitudes of the guards, like John Wayne, you know, you were speaking, Joe, you were speaking about how people kind of bend the rules and kind of make things. And you'll see those types of guards in the system, and a lot of their fellow officers won't say anything. A lot of things that they do, like whether they go in and decide, okay, this person's bunk's made, it was so much exact, like how, okay, the one prisoner you were talking about, what's his name?
4816.
Okay, when he was like, when they would go in and mess with the guy whose bed, I guess that's 4816?
Yeah.
Okay, when they would go in and continuously mess with him. It's so funny because after the shift change, a new shift comes on and they take place and they start messing with that same inmate. It's like almost like, hey, this is the guy. We're messing with him. Let's continue to mess with him.
And well, you but see then I think things. that new guard shift that comes on, they're looking at their peers, these other guards, and they're yeah. like, why couldn't you get control of this or what? And it wasn't necessarily out of control at that moment. Mm-hmm. But, you know, maybe you were a little lenient. Maybe we can really teach him the lesson.
Right.
So then there's some kind of competitive thing between these peer groups, too, that then suffers on the same inmate.
Has anybody ever done replicated this experiment with women?
I don't know. I want to say after this and the Milgram experiment, that's how we got IRB, and that's how, which is Institutional Review Board, mm-hmm. that reviews our research with human subjects and doesn't allow us to do things like that for good reason.
Definitely. So it's hard for me to, it was hard for me to see some of the things that they went through because, you know, like, just knowing what other people and being able to see this, it's like, wow, you know, they really went all out, you know, some of, as they took on their roles. And, you know, like I was explaining earlier, what do you do when someone comes in and, like what you was explaining earlier, I think you were talking about how the other inmate that replaced him came in and they focused their anger and everything toward him. And, you know, and there's that solidarity and amongst the inmates against this new person that comes in. So it's almost like these people here are so used to doing what they're supposed to do and they're almost institutionalized. So, and here comes someone who comes in new, who's never been in there, and he's like questioning the system. And they're like, hey, don't question the system, just go with it because you're going to make things hard on us. Because we already know what's going to happen if you go ahead and go against the system. So, you know, I thought that part was very unique as well.
Really great example of internalized dominance and internalized oppression.
Yeah.
You know, the way that a person can become so complicit, I guess, in their own marginalization.
Yeah.
You know, it's really... I don't know, this movie kind of sticks with you in a really dirty way.
Yeah.
And not dirty as in, you know, Sharon Stone. Basic instinct dirty, but dirty as in like, oh my God, how does this happen? You know?
How quickly?
Yeah.
How very quickly their, you know, perceived identity changes based on the environment that they're put in. I mean, it really has to make you reflect on the environments of your life or the relationships of your life and how very quickly we probably more than we are willing to consider conform and flex and lose some of our own authenticity to conform to the environment.
Yeah, and it's so right because it's like, as I'm sitting here thinking about it, and I don't mean to pick on any particular group of people, or institutions, but it made me think about Greek life and hazing. A few years ago, Rolling Stone ran an expose of Greek life at one of the Ivy League institutions, and the stories were just disgusting. I mean,
this is a podcast. Kids were willing to
I mean, here they're supposed to be some of, you know, the nation's next generation of elite leaders, and they're doing things like, you know, defecating on a slip and slide and having pledges slide down, slipping, slip and slide. I mean, just really degrading and disgusting stuff. And everyone ends up being complicit in this behavior and ultimately promoting this behavior. And it makes me question, is that a characteristic or a proclivity that was already in them and they were just looking for a space to get that kind of derision out, because under normal circumstances it's completely socially unacceptable? Or is it something about being thrust into a particular position that manifests things that are deeply latent within us that normally aren't a part of
our character? I think the situation might be power. Like, let's talk about the power in this film. So again, we've got inmates being treated awful, but now we have guards who are, you know, like we talked about John Wayne, who are nice little late teen, early 20s boys who just kind of lose their mind and are doing stuff. And there's quotes, I have some written down, you know, like, I have to find one. But they were talking about that I became everything I hate and I enjoyed it.
Like, yeah,
that's why I was interested in whether or not the study has been replicated with women, because a part of it seemed to me like, you know, some kind of manifestation of an assumed notion of masculinity and male identity, you know, exactly, dominance. And would women respond in the same way because of a matter of socialization and the ways in which we construct the notion of being masculine versus being feminine? I mean, I don't have an answer, but that was something that just kind of like swirled around my head after the end credits rolled, because it was like, would this have been different if this was a cast of all females instead of all males?
Well, gender certainly plays a prevalent role throughout the real life occurrence and throughout the film.
I read a New Yorker article, and they were talking about when that ad was put in the paper, that it actually put in the phrase prison life. Did you do any research on this? So the people who responded, although they went through these psychological tests and whatever to determine that they were quote-unquote normal or mentally healthy, they had in there this prison life thing. So let me read a little bit from this article. They recreated the original ad and then ran a separate ad omitting the phrase prison life. They found that the people who responded to the two ads scored differently on a set of psychological tests. Those who thought that they would be participating in a prison study had significantly higher levels of aggressive, authoritative, you know, narcissism, social dominance, and they scored lower on measures of empathy and altruism. So there was a difference when we had other people responding to an ad that wasn't talking about the prison thing. So they have some predisposition to some of this.
Well, so Zimbardo, his anecdotal observation, and by the way, you know, that's really all we have from this is what meaning we make of it. It, you know, there wasn't a control group, etc. But he said he believed about a third of the people who were the guards, and by the way, guard or prisoner, that was just a flip of a coin.
Yes.
But a third of the guards, he thought, really had sadistic tendencies that became empowered.
Yeah, and I was just about to touch on that. It's almost philosophical when you think about it. He said the only thing that separated them was a coin toss. Yeah. So, you know, if you think about that coin toss as we relate it to everyday living, the people who live on one side of tracks and the other people who live on another side of tracks, and how they grew up and whatnot, you know, what can determine what a person's chances are throughout life. You know, it can be a coin toss, or it could be the privilege of having a coin toss. So I thought that was really, you know, I thought that was pretty interesting as well.
So some of what we might be touching on that I wanted to talk about was what this says about human nature. And when I was thinking of it as a sort of a two-dimensional cartoonish, I thought, well, they're just trying to send this pessimistic message that people are evil at their core. But I'm not sure about that. And I think we kind of need to look at each person individually. And so I'm going to go back, Leanne, to your question about Zimbardo. Zimbardo, he's just wanting to see how far he can get this to go. And even the John Wayne character, he had just seen the movie Cool Hand Luke. Mm-hmm. And so he knew there was a Hawthorne effect. He knew he was in an experiment. And so he was wanting to really stir the pot and make the experiment work. Mm-hmm. And so he was playing it to the hilt and you know, not recognizing. And so then 4816 and John Wayne, you know, they interview each other at the end, and John Wayne is saying, but I'm a nice guy. You know, and how often have we heard people who have committed atrocities saying, but I'm a nice guy? And so they don't recognize their effect on other people.
Yeah, Hitler was apparently great with children.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I mean, so talking about human nature, it makes you wonder, you know, people always ask, like, what would I have done if I were in Germany during the 1930s and 1940s? And we all think that we would have been the hero and that we would have resisted. But somewhere between a third to two-thirds of us would have conformed.
Yeah, and I think that's very true to human nature, that sense of, man, I better go with the flow, you know. And I even think, because I've known guards to come in very easygoing, and they come in and like, oh man, they're so smooth and they're young and they take their leads and their cues from the older guards. So when they come in at first, and about a month later, they're different people and they start acting just like the veterans that were there. And so you can't even talk, and you know, you can't, at times when you could have talked to them when they first come in and even have a conversation with them, a month later, sometimes 2 months, definitely 2 months later, you can't even have that same level of conversation with them, you know. And it's, then I've also met a guy who was in prison, and he was a guard. And the reason why, he said he could not take it anymore. And he had to leave because he saw the dynamics of how guards treated inmates, and you know why he ended up in prison was really irrelevant. But he said he was a guard, and he said he could not deal with that internally. He was in turmoil when he seen people having unfair treatment by guards or being ridiculed or targeted, and so he had to leave that. So, you know, I see many of the different aspects. I see many of the people who come in, and they come in with one mindset. Like, I've seen people come in like, man, I'm going to just do my time and get out of here. And then they're faced with different situations where they're made like, hey, I'm going to toughen up, and they change over a course of time. It's not usually one day or 2 days, usually over a course of time, and their experiences they have while they're in prison, and they may end up coming out either worse than they came in, or, you know, or they'll come in, or they'll leave out sometimes broken. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's very...
See how that would happen.
It's very, like, inmates see these things, and so they witness these things vicariously, looking at them and think to themselves, well, I'm not going to have that happen to me. So, you know, I'm going to act according to how I know I should act to go ahead and survive. And, you know, it was the whole complexity, especially John Wayne. I've seen those type of police in there, you know.
What do you think that is in the true, you know, person that's in the system? Is that just a control trip? I mean, what is that?
I think...
the ability to do it?
I think it comes from a place of fear sometimes, because they don't want to be targeted. They have these perceptions and whatnot. And especially when you go into the corrections and whatnot, they play these different videos of violent inmates or inmates getting out of control. I've got a chance to witness some of these because I went to, I've been to gang, like gang conference, and they'll show these different videos of what the inmates and the gangs are like. And, you know, you need to be on point and on cue at all times. And they show the worst of the worst. When in all reality, there's a lot of people who are trying to just do their time and live day to day so they can get back out. And, you know, there are some elements of danger and whatnot, but to the degree of what they bombard them with when they go in there, they're just prepared to be, sometimes they're prepared to be assholes when they come in to show that they have the authority over people, and they're going to subject that authority to them no matter if they're aggressive or not aggressive.
That's a good point. I never thought about that. Very good point.
Yeah, and the real life John Wayne, his name is Dave Eshelman, seems like a really nice guy.
So he said.
I mean, he was basically, his job was to role play, and so he was being the best role player that he could be. Yeah. But he had a great quote that I think relates to this power. He says, "The study showed that power corrupts." Hmm. "And how difficult it is for people who are the victims of abuse to stand up and defend themselves. Why doesn't anybody who's being abused by a spouse just say, stop it?" And then we realize now that's not as easy as it sounds.
Yeah.
And that's good.
And thinking about that, I think about people who are in professional roles as advocates, you know, and I think about how the mother was questioning and they were like, hey, you know, and on the real sense, if you don't have someone who's persistently out on the outside advocating for you, a lot of your cries, a lot of things won't be heard to either get you some glasses or get you some medical treatment or get you what you need when you're in prison. So when I think about the mother who was questioning why her son wasn't getting, was looking tired or wasn't getting enough sleep. And, you know, I thought about how, what that looks like as far as being in prison and someone needing someone out there to advocate, because you can't get calls all the time. You can't get a chance to see your you can't get a chance to see visits, get visits all the time so people can see you. So I think about those in context to the movie and me now being a counselor, or, you know, aspiring to be a counselor educator and teaching about advocacy in a sense when you do have a client that can't really speak out, and being able to help them speak out or speaking out with them so they can get any type of assistance or the type of services they need.
This article that I was reading says, so was the study about our individual fallibility or about broken institutions? Was the finding of this experiment about prisons or about life in general?
Both.
All of the above.
Yeah,
agreed.
But do we ever hear Zimbardo's hypothesis going into this? I mean, what was his focus? Was it, I think it was about humans and behavior, but was it about the institution as well? Because they discuss.
Well, I think that it was about how people respond to these situations.
And the institution is a character in these situations.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, it seems to me like the institution is incidental. It's a really...
Right.
I mean, a prison... I mean, you could have done the same experiment in a school. You know, an institution is an institution. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really just what role are you assigned within that institution? Mm-hmm. What... avenues of power do you have access or don't have access to, and who's watching? You know, I thought a lot about, sorry to sound like a total egghead, but Michel Foucault's Discipline and Punish and the nature of punishment and internal regulation of the body and internal regulation of behavior, shifting from, you know, behavior used to be controlled in punishment by things like drawing and quartering someone in the town square, you know, leaving them out to bake in the sun in the blocks, you know, And but then over time it shifted to with the rise of the penal system, behavior shifted, regulation of behavior, of undesirable behavior shifted to more of a focus of the self. Mm-hmm. And thinking about, all right, so what can I do and what can't I do? And then now, of course, you have a camera in every possible corner you can possibly think of. And so now we regulate our behaviors even more because we're afraid of getting caught on camera. So what happens if you're in a situation where there is no one looking? And even if someone is looking, you can pretty much rest assured that they're gonna fall down on your side in your favor anyway, like all the guards ultimately did. They all ultimately stood up for each other. And that's the same thing that we hear about in protest and complaints against law enforcement, you know, the thin blue wall. They all always stand up for each other even when they're in the wrong. So, you know, I don't think that it really matters which institution, whether it was the Stanford prison experiment or the Stanford public school experiment. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all going, I think we might all be subject to the same kind of results, you know, regardless of who we are, which is totally scary because I wonder what I would do.
I did. I mean, you have to look at this and go, just like you were talking about, it's easy to go, well, I would be this or, and you, Andre, were talking about this whole survival thing. Like, I'm just going to keep my head down and do my time. Yeah. And so even if you thought you were that, we saw characters in this movie really have that state of mind for a couple of days. Mm-hmm. And then that changed. There was a transformation that took place. True. So we don't know until we're in it, but I hope to not ever be in such an experiment.
Have any of the participants written about their experiences, or?
Well, they're in the documentaries on YouTube. I mean, they're interviewed. They, the real people, they talk about it.
And several of them actually went on to work in various leadership capacities in prisons. Wow. And work with jails and teach people that are in that environment, even if they became educators. I mean, it shaped them partially. So there's, you know, there's a lot of comment that it didn't permanently hurt them, that they weren't harmed in this, because that's the ethics matter, right?
Right.
I mean, that's the crest of the ethical concern. But like, I think I've read at least four or five that ended up somehow into something related to the prison system.
So clearly we didn't learn anything, though, you know? Prison reform is hard. I mean, it's harder to reform prisons than it is to reform schools, and that's hard, you know? And so the question for me becomes, outside of any social or pop cultural import, you know,
it was 1971.
Was there any success to the Stanford prison experiment, you know?
Well, we got IRB. I mean, we got human subjects review.
Yeah, but that was kind of a long train coming, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, part of the way that I can relate to this, and I, you know, in my mind, I think of myself as a rebel. Mm-hmm. You know, other people may think differently. I am proud to say in my high school class, I was voted most radical. But for at least half of my life, more than half of my life, 30 years, I have almost always been in an authority position. And whether I'm in a teacher's lounge or I'm in a mental hospital or in a university, I have seen people who have power.
You said mental hospital twice.
University. That's what
I see. But I have seen that, you know, this group thing can happen, and there's a real, I think, of attribution theory in this. We want to blame people for the position that they're in. You know, and that's a prevalent narrative in Western culture, is, you know, this bootstraps mentality that wherever somebody is in life is based on how hard they tried. And if somebody is in an impoverished, marginalized position, it's because they didn't try hard enough. If somebody has a lot, it's because they deserve it.
Right.
That is a prevalent narrative. And I think this just this experiment debunks that.
And it also, in a really uncomfortable way, reminds us how fragile humans really are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, to be able to ultimately sacrifice, to be a self-described nice guy, and then walk into a situation like that, and within 36 hours, you're being abusive to a total stranger for no other reason than you think you can. I mean, that really says a lot about who we are and the precarious relationship between identity, morality, spirituality, etc.
I think would have been even more interesting is to have a multicultural dynamic.
Oh, exactly where I was just getting ready to go. So I'm like, it's 1971. They're doing it based on what really happened.
Right.
But were there no other ethnicities that we responded to the ad?
Stanford. I know we're talking about 1971.
True. And
it might have been different if it was the. It might have been different if it was, you know, the Berkeley Prison Experiment.
Maybe or something like that.
See, because I would have loved to see how people of color would have been treated versus the white, the people of whiteness that were inmates.
Right.
And see those different dynamics play out. Because, you know, sometimes in prison, you see those dynamics play out where people are getting preferable treatment because of their color of their skin.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that would lend even more credence to the, you know, to the study, you know? So I thought about that. I was like, wow, I wonder what would have happened if this would have been a black inmate or this would have been a Latino inmate, you know, versus a white inmate. You know, I just thought like, wow, that would have probably made this even that more phenomenal as far as, you know, the rich data collected from this experiment.
There's a part of me that, I mean, there's a part of me that completely feels you.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another part that says, probably not. Because the social relationships among the races at that time were already so strained.
Mm.
And there was already such a stratification of American culture that the idea that, you know, a white person being labeled a prison guard would be abusive to a black person being labeled a prisoner. That's, it almost seems like that's a no-brainer.
Right.
You know, but, I'm, as horrible as it is to say that, but that's
but the still, feeling. It would have been a nice contrast to see how, you know, when, who they would have targeted first, because there was no one to target but white inmates.
Yeah.
You know, to say that, okay, there's a Latino, and he's like, he just gives me this look because there's a multicultural aspect to the way people react and interrelate to each other. So just being able to, you know, just where white inmates might have been able to fly under the radar because these black and Latino inmates would have been the subject of targeting and whatnot. And, you know, when I think about experiments, I think about them being fair and telling a true story of what goes on as far as, you know, marginalization, oppression, and even, you know, those subcultures of oppression and marginalization within different, you know, facets of our society and those communities within. So, you know, that's just me speaking because I was like, wow, you know, there's a lot of things that I can relate to, but, you know, I would like everyone to be able to see a true picture of what it may look like, because that's only a small window of what things look like and how things go on.
I can feel that.
Well, and I want to come back to gender for a second, and one part of the humiliation of the prisoners involved trying to emasculate them by having them wear these burlap dresses. There was a lot of homoeroticism in the film and in what happened in real life. Hmm. They were prisoners being forced to simulate sexual acts with each other.
Right.
You know, and Zimbardo, when the parents of 4816 came, and Mom was advocating, but Zimbardo took Dad aside, like a good old boys club, and said, you know, I think he can tough it out, mm-hmm. and really played on the machismo.
Right?
Yeah. And then Zimbardo's girlfriend, who was also, I believe, his graduate assistant, and I, you know, and on one hand, I want to say that was really shown in to show the domination and power, but it was also what happened in real life. And now they're happily married.
They're married, yeah.
But it wasn't until, and her name is Christine Maslach, played by Olivia Thirlby. It wasn't until she came in and said to him, like, what's going on here? Do you realize what you're doing? And that was a wake-up call for him. And then he went in and he just broke the whole thing up after 6 days instead of the
It wasn't tubes. Based on that conversation with her, though. It was about pretending like they were screwing camels or whatever. How did they say it? Like, it was, he's watching them do this sexual practice thing, whatever the guards have told him to do. He does this, he goes in and breaks it up, as if that's gone too far. That conversation with her was right before that, but did you get the impression that he broke it up based on her wishes? And
I felt like it was cumulative.
Yeah.
It's just everything, like, over time, like too day much. By day by day.
Yeah.
It's like, here's another thing. Here's another thing.
Yes.
I think I'm about to lose tenure.
Almost like sowing seeds. Right. Like, you know, everyone's telling him, like, man, I don't know if this is right. And everything's building up, like you said, cumulative. So all these things piling up, and it's in his brain already that, hey, you know, even though he has a directive that he wants to go ahead and see unfold, and then it just starts piling up, like, you know, hey, this is going on, this is going on, this is going on. This may not be a good idea to continue on. And especially in lieu of all the conversations with his girlfriend, what he's witnessed himself.
And when is enough? The behavior's getting bigger. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to go to the sexual part.
Yeah. And so I want to read the little blurb that comes on at the very end of the movie about Philip Zimbardo. And it says, as a result of the experiment, Dr. Philip Zimbardo shifted the focus of his work and dedicated himself to educating others about the psychology of authority and the abuse of power. He continues to lecture on the subject around the world. Mm-hmm. So I guess how I want to conclude this podcast today, if we could go back to you, Dre.
Yeah.
Now, thank you so much for sharing your experiences and your impressions of this film.
Yes.
Now, you've talked about being in prison, and
right.
Now you are a doctoral student on the way to becoming a counselor educator, and just wondering if you could fill us in on how'd you get from there to here?
How I got from there to here, I had a life course transition. I had two sons, and I had something more to live for, because before I didn't really care about life and care about putting myself in certain situations. And here I am, I'm forced to be a father. What does being a father mean to me? You know, it's something bigger than myself. So I had to change course and, okay, what would I want to do? What's the impression I want to leave to my sons? What's the legacy I want to teach them? I want to teach them, you make mistakes, but you get up and then you continue to try to be a better person and learn from them. So they were my, you know, how would you say, my motivation to change. So I found that motivation within being a father to be a better person, to teach people who are going to come up and look at me for guidance or whatnot. So I decided, you know, okay, what's the first thing I need to do? Educate myself. So I started educating and I found myself pulled in, and I found this community of support, you know, which was spearheaded by a professor, a psychology professor. She opened up doors for me that were closed, you know, and, you know, her name's Margot Underwood, awesome psychology professor. And she, when she opened up these doors, other people looked at me for the first time and saw me as a person who was trying to do better, but needed a little bit of help. And that kind of continued to go. Police chief of the college, he helped me. And then once I left and I came here, I learned something from that. I learned that you need to ask for help. You need to ask for direction, but you need to be careful who you ask for help, because you just can't ask everyone. So I found some professors here at NIU who's been continuously in the sociology department that was like, hey, you can do this. We can do this. We're behind you. And that community support within the education system helped propel me and helped motivate me and push me toward the things I want to do. They assisted me in finding, you know, what my calling was and whatnot, because I didn't know what I wanted to do. You asked me like 10 years ago if I would even have a master's degree, I would have laughed. You asked me 5 years ago if I would be in a master's program, I would have laughed. If you'd have told me that I would be in a doctoral program, I would say, man, there's something wrong with you. Maybe you need to go ahead and get checked out, or, you know, get off that crack or that weed that you're smoking or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, here I am today.
Yeah, well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So thank you, everybody, for listening. And you can find us all over social media. Our webpage is mentalillnessinpopculture.podomatic.com. Thanks to Tyler Campbell for our new logo and artwork. And you could also find us on Facebook, Mental Illness in Pop Culture. Email, mentalillnessinpopculture@gmail.com. We are on iTunes or your podcast listening app of choice. And we are on Twitter, MINPC is our Twitter handle. So thanks, everybody. Next week, we will be talking about Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys in Love and Mercy. Boy, that Wilson family, they put the fun in dysfunctional, and we'll kind of talk about some of the mental health issues involved there.
He made some great music, man.
Oh, my gosh. All right.
Thanks.
Thanks. Bye. For having me. See you guys.
All right.